Welcome to season two of Witchlit, a space to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. Katrina Messenger, a radical feminist of African, Cherokee, and Irish descent, is a founding elder of the Order of the Elemental Mysteries and the founder of the Reflections Mystery School and Connect DC. Katrina works extensively with mythology, dream work, ritual, and trance as means of self-exploration, self-healing, and self-evolution. She believes that any attempt to change the external world must be paired with the inner work of personal spiritual practice. She's the author of Descent, A Journey for Women, Dark Beauty, and Elemental Psychology, Using Jungian Psychology and the Sacred Elements for Spiritual Development, and has published articles in Reclaiming Quarterly and 12 Wild Swans. Katrina Messenger, welcome to Witchlit.
Thank you. I'm really glad to be here. Thank you so much for the opportunity to discuss my book with you.
Yeah, I'm excited. I enjoyed the book and can't wait to ask you more questions. But our first question for everybody is, why write? When there are other ways that we can communicate these days through podcasts or other mediums, why write books?
Well, part of it is that I initially thought of writing as a way to get the word out about some of the things I was discovering in my research and in my practice and in my experience that I thought would be a good way to share it beyond the people who could see me when I went around and did teaching around in the Mid-Atlantic area about the topics. And I was getting so excited about it. Folks says, when are you going to write a book? I mean, that was the way folks talked, you know, back in the old days, you know, when are you going to write a book about all this? Because I kept saying, well, I'm covering stuff, but I've already gone beyond it, but there's more to it. And they were like, well, then, you know, you need to write it down. And I was like, oh, okay. And I guess I went to writing because that is part of my craft, right? It's part of the way I work in the world is writing. I spend most of my years out in the world talking as a political activist and as a technology expert. I spent most of my time talking and not necessarily writing, except if I was writing technical documents or something, or articles, you know, editorials or whatever. And so when it came time for me to, okay, so how do I get this out? How do I get to the stuff I never get to get to in class? Writing came up forward as, oh yeah, you know, I wrote for this, I wrote for that. Maybe I could, you know, right now I could sit down and start writing. The funny thing is I started writing this book as a way to get out of writing another book that people had asked for. And so, so for that other book, which has never seen the light of day, every time I got bored with it, I would go over, let me just write a little short article, slip it away. And then, oh, how about another little short article? And then this one article kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and that became Elemental Psychology. Mm-hmm. So at some point, one of my friends teased me because I still had a line in the book that says, that's why I'm writing this article. It says, Katrina, I don't think it's an article anymore. And so it just took over my life. Like I had to get this stuff down. And although it took me 10 years to write it, it was mostly because I was also doing other things, right? Mm-hmm. As we all do, we have lives. I was dealing with my chronic illnesses and the fact that I was going to go for early retirement from my work. But writing the book was the subject matter was the subject of such strong inclinations in me that I needed to share it. And as opposed to doing it, say, on a podcast, or that would be a series of lectures that, like, you know, going on forever, right? Because mm-hmm. there's so much material there. And so by the time I would get to the last lecture, right, I would have to redo everything because everything had changed, right? So it was like, I might as well write a book and then just say in person, now, you know, I used to say this, but now this, mm-hmm. you know. So I think it was a way to for me to get what I was learning and coming to understand out in one chunk and get it in somebody else's hands so I can go on and do other things that I'm avoiding because I'm writing other things, mm-hmm. you know, the usual.
I think it just goes to prove that writers will find ways to procrastinate writing, including writing other things.
Yes. That'll teach that other book. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll just write something else. Yeah. I love that. So you kind of gave us like the kernel for this book and why it came to be, but what was the process like of, because you self-published, right? This is a self-published book. So what was the process of like making that decision and kind of how did you go through actually getting the book out in the world?
Well, it was sort of like I was noticing, like, you know, I have friends who are writers, including family members, and they were all going through different methods to get their stuff published. It was at a time where everything was changing so rapidly, and I wasn't quite sure where I could bring this book, right? In some of the early books that one of my friends gave me, I think it was Thorne, suggested that I make, you know, the 60-second and the you know, the elevator speech and whatever, and or the story of how my book go out. And I kept saying, well, I'm going to go on Oprah, you know, and you know, all that kind of stuff. But in reality, I wasn't quite sure where to go or what to do with it. And it was hard enough to write. And there were times where I almost walked away. Like I almost threw the whole thing away. I didn't know about such things as writer deserts. And it was really hard. And Ivo had told me a story that on one of his books, he had actually erased the whole book and started over at one point. So I was of the opinion, well, that's what I need to do. I need to erase the whole thing. And my brother and his partner in New Zealand wrote me and says, first off, send us what you have. And don't you dare delete it. Start over in a new file. And that's where you write. And don't go back looking at the book until you've calmed yourself the hell down. Right. They like, this, my big brother was like, no, you are not doing that.
Oh, it's so important to have those cheerleaders in your court. It's so important to have them. Man.
Yeah. It's like they came out the woodwork and it was like, no, you don't. So I was, very humble and full of humility, you know, walked over and opened up a blank page and started typing, you know. And then at some point I went back to the manuscript, looked at it and says, hey, this is pretty good. Who wrote this? Because it was no longer recognizable to me as what I had been struggling with. It was a book, right? It wasn't Katrina's painful secret kind of thing, whatever it is I imagined, or her horrific fantasy. And so it turned into a book. And so the things that I had been writing, you know, it was like, oh yeah, this goes with this. This goes here. This goes here. It was perfect. And so I learned a lot about the writing process. Since then, I've been listening to other writers. And I see that what I went through was typical. It's like those things happen. And you have to know that so you can weather it and know that it's part of the process. You have to get to that place where it's like you're parched. And then and let yourself go there. And then you come out on the other side. And that was a deep lesson for me. That was really helpful.
Yeah. And I do think that is one of those things that, like you said, having... I think it's important to have the cheerleaders, but I also think it's important to have, like you said, the writers in your life who've been through this, because even like I'm in the middle of writing book 6 and I'm at that point where I'm like, this is garbage. I don't know how to write a book. What am I doing? And then I'll put it away for a couple of weeks and go back and go, okay, maybe it's not garbage.
Yeah.
Maybe it just needs a lot of revision, you know? It's such a process. And I think, you know, when you're in the middle, like you said, of writing a book, you read it so often, you're like, this is terrible. Like you, cause you get like that contempt of the familiar from reading your own stuff over and over. And yeah, it's a weird life. It's a weird life.
And there's so many small M myths about writing. Right. And you know, that, I was telling someone recently that a person like Neil Gaiman scares the hell out of me because he just says, oh, I have to write a such and such and such and such. And he sits down and just writes it out. Mm-hmm. Right. And I said, to me, he writes books the way I write code, you know, because I can write, I'm also do software development. And I said, like, I don't have to like be in the mood to write the code. It was like, oh, this needs to be done. Okay, done. Right? That's how he writes. And so every time I think about him, it always sends shivers to me as a writer. But every writer is not the same. And he's a master of the craft, right? You know, and wherever I am on my road of self-discovery and evolution as a writer, I'm not there yet. And so to compare myself to him or Toni Morrison, who wrote every night after she put the kids to bed, right? After working all day, helping other people get published, you know, right? So these people are like, oh, they're like gods, you know, it's like, their writing process is something to behold, but that's not where I'm at. And permission to be where I am is what I teach every day, you know, in my school, in my order, in my tradition, and in my community, right?
Yeah.
And so here I am going, oh my God, I'm not like Toni Morrison. I should be working on this on a regular basis. And it was like, oh my God, that's insane. That's not who I am.
Yeah.
And it's not how I have to work. And then it's like, we have to also be, you know, really cognizant of our own limits. Like for me, it was like, I'm very much a spoon person, right? Do I have enough spoons? And so me trying to think that I can do something and commit to doing it every single day without fail is unrealistic. And it's setting me up to feel bad about myself. It doesn't set me up to feel good about what I'm able to do. And so I had to pull myself. It was like, yeah, I can read about them and their process because they teach me about how the process works. Mm-hmm. But I can't model what I do after them. It has to fit me in my real life with my real circumstances in my life. And so being able to write became something that I could give myself, but it wasn't something I could do every day. It was just not possible. And hooray when I can do it. At one point it was sort of like, if I got 2 writing sessions in a week, that was considered, you know, I was ready to win, you know, the Super Bowl, you know, that was fabulous.
Yeah.
And I just think those realistic assessments of what you can and can't do is so important.
Mm-hmm. I think it's important what you said about there are a lot of myths about writing. I think that's, did graduate degree in creative writing and poetry, which has nothing to do with writing novels in reality. But I think it made me a better writer just because of the revision process and, you know, the specificity of language in poetry. So I think you can learn a lot of things from other writers and from reading other stuff. But like you said, when it comes down to it, it's your writing and how you work and how your brain works. And actually, Neil Gaiman has said something really interesting about that. It's like only you can tell your story.
Yeah.
You know, there's a story that only you can tell. And, you know, you're the person who's going to have to figure out how to do that ultimately.
Yeah. So. And you can't set it up so that you fall in your place, you know, fall on your face because you have unrealistic expectations. Mm-hmm. The other small myth that I had to deal with, small M myth, was that you're a writer when you're writing, when you're actually in the process of writing. Mm-hmm. And if you're not writing, you call yourself a writer. And that was huge, right? It was like, well, I'm having breakfast. That means I'm not a writer because I'm not writing right now. And that's how I would talk myself through that. And then finally, it was the idea that a writer has to think. The writer has to have their creative side fed. Mm-hmm. A writer has to read. You know, there's all these things that are part of being a writer. And writing is one of the ways you get to see the artifacts of that process. But that's not the only process. Right. And being able to know that, like I discussed these ideas with people all over the place over those years, 10 years or more. My best friend Kelly and I, we talked about this kind of stuff every single day for, you know, years. And so the idea that all that was wasted effort, that wasn't part of the process, is like, no, that was me being a writer, figuring things out and getting excited about a topic. And so those small myths get in the way of people being able to feel that that is something that they can do.
Mm-hmm. I agree totally. For you, like what is the thing that most feeds your creative well for writing? Like what is the thing that you really draw from, do you think?
Reading. Reading is a big part of it, but actually, you know, of my multitudinous list of titles, I spend a lot of time in you might consider it meditation, but it's in contemplation. And I spend a lot of time just letting things, walking through, you could say, the mansions in my mind. I'm a mystic. So I really, the same skill I use as a technologist to understand complex systems and be able to navigate, put them all into my, you know, cortex, and then navigate through them to figure out how they work or why I was not working, is the exact same way I approach my spiritual work. I go to that area and I look at things, you know, I pull in patterns, trends, things I've read, things I've seen, things I've experienced, things my clients, my students experience, friends, whatever. And I look for the thread and I follow the thread, and then I get to, oh my goodness, I see now, that's the pattern. And my work as to get certified as an archetypal pattern analyst brought all those skills together. And so I do that when I do the analyzation of myths and archetypes and stories and even news and dreams, and draw out the patterns, the large mm-hmm. patterns. But it's similar when I was going through and reading about all the ways the ancients use the elements to characterize human diversity. Mm-hmm. And then comparing that then to what Jung was doing, I said, oh my goodness, he drew from all these. This is where his source material is. And that came from me reading and then putting everything together. Mm-hmm. So that reading and then having time to think, those mm-hmm. are critical. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Interesting you say reading, because I think a lot of writers get their inspiration from reading other stuff widely. But while reading your book, I was like, this would be a great book for writers to read, especially fiction writers who develop characters. Because they're, you know, in addition to understanding ourselves, I think to be a writer who develops good characters, you have to understand yourself.
Yeah.
And how your brain works and how you function. And then to make, you know, characters on the page who really come to life for people. And I was like, this would be a great book for writers to read for that reason, to really think about like character motivation. Cause you know, as a fiction writer, I've sat through a lot of like goal motivation, you know, in classes on how to develop characters. And you're just like, I don't want to read that anymore. Like what's the foundation for that? Like, that's what I want to talk about. And your book is what I think the foundation for those kind of classes are, actually.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I can see that. You know, one of the books that I read was some of the master book of characters, the story plots. And I was going through and picking out, oh, there's an archetype. That's the story of so-and-so, so-and-so. Oh, I know where they got that from. And so it was really fun mm-hmm. for me. And when people would ask me, it was like, you know, Katrina, you know a lot about myth. I said, well, yeah, but I also know a lot about patterns. And here's a great book. Master characters. Yeah. And so that was part of the input to my mm-hmm. process in writing my book. So I could see how it could go back the other way as well. That's interesting. I like that.
Yeah. Another marketing venue, perhaps.
Yes.
But no, I was just like, yeah, I took a lot of notes reading it. And I was like, yeah, this is so helpful just to think about, you know, how, especially when you're, you know, in your own life, when you're trying to figure out, like, I think, you know, obviously the book is written more from like your spiritual practice and trying to figure out why you do the things you do in relationships with other people and those kind of things. But that plays into writing on the same level, like to create yeah. a place that people can go and, oh, these people are real.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
have to do that as a writer too. So. Yeah. And we spend so much time in our heads as writers, like, you need to know what's going on in there, I think.
Well, the other thing I used to do, and it was after I did this for a while that I wrote some fiction during one of the NaNoWriMos. I haven't done anything with it. But I used to go out to cafes. You know, this was one of the things I missed out on with COVID. I used to just go places and listen to people. Mm-hmm. Right. And I just like listening to the conversation. It wasn't like I was like going, "Ooh, what are they doing?" It was more like listening to things. It became part of the compost that's sort of laying in the areas in my mind that now I can draw upon. And so when I was talking about examples of how this may play out, well, I was pulling on those type of things. It was like, well, look at this system, look at this. Then you can see it there, you can see it here. Especially when I was doing this stuff about mapping the soul, mapping the Western soul, and talking about how it is we could look at this from a different perspective by looking and providing that same analysis of cultures and countries and things. So yeah.
I was fascinated by that part because I don't think I had ever thought about, I mean, it makes total sense when you put it on the, you're just like, oh yes, of course. But I had never thought about like, what are the typologies of cultures and how does that affect, you know, then how does that affect everyone who lives in that culture and how those cultures interact with each other? Just like how we interact interpersonally, like that whole part of the book, I was like, this feels like this could be a whole book by itself. Like there's a whole other book in those like few paragraphs talking about that.
Yeah. Well, I always like to point out the ugly American stereotype is actually the personification of our national type. and it's only viewed that way if you're the opposite type. And what it is that many of the Eastern nations at the time were very introverted. So, of course, an extroverted American is the archetype for America. And so the ugly American is literally our type viewed from the world. And it's very funny because I've gone places, you know, in Europe, where because I'm fairly quiet and introverted, you know, you wouldn't think I was introverted. Most people think I'm extroverted. I'm not. That when I go places, I don't, you know, I keep to myself, right? And then somebody will walk in and be loud and proud, and the people all around me near me go, "American," and I go, "Whoops." that was telling.
Yeah. Yeah, I've spent a lot of time in Eastern Europe, and I too am introverted, and people are sometimes surprised, like, "But you have a podcast." I was like, "Yes, but I'm also a hermit." To spend a lot of time in Eastern Europe, and people are very I mean, I think culturally Eastern Europe is even more introverted than Western Europe,
right?
In a lot of ways. And, you know, occasionally people would be surprised I was American. I'm like, you know, they're introverted Americans too. Then still there would always be those times where I would be pegged as American and I hadn't even opened my mouth. And someone told me once,
smiled.
I smiled, and because I walk like I have all the space I need.
Yeah.
And I was like, that is really interesting. Is that so there's still these cultural things, even as introverted people, that we carry with us because of the culture we're from. And I was like, that totally makes sense to me. I didn't enjoy being pegged, but it was interesting and illustrative too. So.
Yeah. I loved the little stealth that I had. The funny part was when I was in Norway, and we'll get back to the book. When I was in Norway, people started speaking to me in Norwegian. And I'm like, okay, hold on. Because, you know, I don't mind being thought of as Cuban. I don't mind being thought of as Samoan. I don't mind being thought of any lots of cultures I've been in. But there is no freaking way that you think I'm a Norwegian.
Or that you had lived there long enough that you had acclimated, I guess.
But they had a large African population there. There was a lot of intermarriage. So in fact, a lot of Norwegians in the capital city did look just like me. Mm-hmm. So, it was pretty funny. I was like, oh, come on.
Yeah, that is like a special feeling traveling there when you get mistaken for native.
Yeah.
Like my husband is from Trinidad and is, you know, a very large Black man. And we've traveled many times in many big cities. And especially when we're in London or New York, people will come up to him and ask him for directions. And he's like, I don't live here. Yeah. Why would you ask me? You just look like you know where you're going. That's like the personality he has. Like he is wherever he is, he knows where he is.
So I tell folks, apparently I look Norwegian. And that's one of my inside jokes. Yes.
I like it.
So, go ahead.
Getting back to the book, although I clearly, you and I can talk about all these other things forever too. I feel like, you know, knowing that you wrote this book over such a long period, and then it's very footnoted, and like, so what does research on a project that long look like? Because it's clear you've done that part of it too, like, you know, just through the footnoting and all of that, that there's a lot of research that went into this book too. So I'm curious what research for a book that you're writing that long looks like, because it seems like your organization of that had to be pretty stellar, because I would not have remembered something I read like 4 years ago to footnote in something.
Well, there was a moment where toward the end where I had to go quickly and look at some things to make sure that if I should put quotes around what I wrote, or should I just do a, you know, and do a citation, or just, you know, think that I paraphrased it and then do a citation. So I had to check a certain things. And at one point I had wrote almost half of a section and then realized that it all hinged on me remembering something in the one book in the, that I remembered it in the right configuration. Mm-hmm. And it was like, you know, this could be done or it could be totally neuro. I think I better stop and go check. You know, and that little thing came up because, yeah, it was totally, I had remembered it incompletely, and I had it backwards. And so I sat there and read over, says, why did this make sense to me? You know, and then I'm reading it through and I said, oh, I know what I was trying to get to. Okay, got it. But it was, let's just say I learned a lot from that. So I'm working on a book now, that's tentatively titled Body Wisdom. And again, I'm dealing with a lot of citations, a lot of research. I'm reading a lot of research, a lot of other people's books, just tons of stuff. And I had to get a place to store it in. So I got Zotero, and then I was already writing in Scrivener. But some tools are made for writers, you know, mm-hmm. I heard about the Zotero and what's the other one, Mendeley, citation management systems from people who are doing dissertations and mm-hmm. scholarly publications. And although I've been published in one juried journal for my craft, archetypal pattern analyst, I'm not quite sure I'm ready to go to, you know, some of the other journals, but I've actually looked at them and thought, you know what, actually I'm doing the level of research that these people are doing. Maybe they will accept an article from me, mm-hmm. you know, but yeah, it's a lot to keep up with. And the answer now is, get yourself a program and put that stuff in it. Yeah. But the other part is I'm learning that I'm used to like taking a book, go somewhere and just being totally absorbed. And it took me 20 years before I would write in a book. Because you know, I grew up, books were sacred, you know, and so you couldn't write in it. And so I finally got to the point that I could write in it, but I use pencil. So now I'm sitting there scribbling notes. This is really important because of this, this links to this, this, and I have all that. And that's how I used to work. And now I'll still get a book and do that sometime, but I find that it's easier for me if I get the book on Kindle so I can highlight and annotate in a system that's already typed. Because mm-hmm. having to translate all that back into electronic form from a book is kind of the old way we used to do it was to take, you know, stacks of index cards with us to the libraries. And yeah, you're shaking your head nodding. Yeah. Yeah. And that was hell because, it, you know, writing down every single quote you came across and all the information so you could have a footnote. You know, next card. And then sometimes the things were so in depth, you wanted to write down several things, right? So now you have a cards with separate rubber bands on them to separate them. That was nuts. Okay.
Yes. Oh, so, God, I remember this so much.
Yeah.
So, that's where I bought color-coded index cards.
Yeah. Yeah. So what I did a lot was, is just if I could, I would grab the quote when I was reading it, if it was on electronic form, like especially on a lot of those scholarly texts. And then the other thing was I had a optical character, was it one of those apps on my phone, and I would take pictures of the whole paragraph and send it through, and it would produce text for me, and then I could just clean it up and then put it somewhere along with the citation. Now I have a much better way of handling all of that. So but that's what you do when you've got to do a lot of research. Like if some of the early stuff that I did, like Descent, my book on Descent myths, there wasn't a lot of citations I had to do because I was talking about myths and folk tales. A lot of them were just like, you know, read Grimm, read this myth from so-and-so, it wasn't citation heavy. Mm-hmm. Now I'm getting to a place where I'm doing research in an area that is going to be really heavily cited work. And so I had to get a real management system for it. I learned the hard way all through to take it seriously. And if you're doing nonfiction and you're not reading the reading in the area of study, and you're not reading the tangential things in the, you know, in the cultural and science and religion and all this other stuff, then you need something. You need something to help ground your work in reality. It can't just be straight, you know, unlike fiction, which can be triggered by the outside, you know, information, like how Toni Morrison wrote the whole Beloved from a news article she saw, right? Mm-hmm. But the thing is that for nonfiction writers, you got to have something that this thing sits in,
right,
and is a part of, and it follows in some path of the craft that you're trying to extend, expand, and experiment and discover. So if you're not doing that, what are you doing? What are you saying about where you fit into the overall legacy of the work that came before us? You know, I always say we stand on stand on the shoulders of giants, and we need to remember them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is very true.
Yeah.
So I was thinking about the book. I am more familiar with Myers-Briggs types just because those are more available in popular culture. You know, you take the test at work 1,000 times. I took in college, you know, all those kind of things. But I know that there are certain Myers-Briggs types that are more likely to be writers. Like I'm an INFJ. So like writer is like the first thing on the list of things you might be as an INFJ.
Yeah.
So do you think, like, in the work that you've done for this book and like as a writer, do you think, I don't know, I just feel like there's a thread that would be interesting to follow about what your Jungian typology is and then how that then affects your work as a writer, like the process and all of the things you go through as a writer. And I don't know that I have like a specific question, but I just wonder if you thought about it that way or like if that had occurred to you.
Well, there's a couple of things I could say about it. Like, number one, all types can be creative. All types can be inventive. All of them can write. All of them can do. I mean, it's like we always have to be very careful when we talk about typology and then what they do with it. Mm-hmm. And we're each individuals. And so it's not whether or not they write, it's what they write about, mm-hmm. right? What they're far more likely to write about. So say, for example, if in this society, being an intuitive, you're in the minority. And so we tend to take an outsider view when we look back at society as a whole. And so you'll find more of us in those things that are considered, you know, outside until they get popular and then they get flooded with the other type. So for example, early science fiction was mostly intuitives. a lot of the counterculture movements were mostly intuitives. But as soon as they hit a place where people could see them and they were, you know, they were seen as something really interesting, then the sensates joined in. So it winds up at the end, the sensates, usually the first thing they do is push out all the intuitives. Because, you know, we're still trying to experiment and they're like, no, we like what you found and don't ever change. And you see that in most movements, mm-hmm. in most religions as well.
Yeah,
they push out the intuitives, the mystics, and the shaman. But the thing is that, yeah, it, the best mix for teams is, of course, to have people of enough diversity that more of those strengths are brought to bear. But yeah, there are certain things that will make each type happier. Right. So I'm an INTJ and we don't handle authority very well unless we think the authority actually knows what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And when if they actually know what they're doing, we will be their best employee because we appreciate mastery. Whereas, an ENFP may find it kind of like, you know, it's terrible that I have a boss who doesn't know what they're doing. But more importantly, it impacts the importance of my work because priority is very important mm-hmm. for introverted waters, introverted feelers. And so it depends. Did I say INFP. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So yeah, the thing is that each type will have different things that are important to them. And in many ways, in one of those sheets, I think one of the tables, I list those statements. I said, in many ways, the one that sounds like your clarion call that you would put on your flag to fly into battle is your type, right? Because mm-hmm. that, caring for people or death, you know, kind of thing. Or mine was like, be correct or die, you know.
I live with an INTJ. My partner is an INTJ.
Yeah, so you know what I'm saying.
I know exactly what you're saying, yes.
So the thing is that they become what we feel is important and what we need to uphold. But depending on where we are and who we're with, different aspects of that will come forward as needed. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, the writing about, like I always joke that, you know, that most of the folks who write the military books and stories or that tend to be sensates, the ones about cowboys and out on the ranch, you know, I always joke, oh, that's all sensates. But if they've gone to the moon and they're flying around and they're facing criminals like Firefly, you know, that's an intuitive. Mm-hmm. Same story, different place, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah, it's not actually that simple. It's a mm-hmm. joke. It is interesting. So yeah. Dr. Kirstie, he talks about how, say, a sensei, an introverted sensei, would love to sit down and show you their collection of salt and pepper shakers from all over the southern states, you know. Mm-hmm. And here's where I was in Arkansas, and here's it. And we intuitives will laugh, right? But how many of us sit down to talk about our favorite characters, our favorite mm-hmm. books, our favorite games? Is exactly that level of detail and that amount of enthusiasm. Yeah. And so we just can't see it sometimes for what it really is. It's just the diversity of humanity. That's all we're looking at is the diversity of humanity. Unfortunately, because of power dynamics, certain things become problematic for people with certain combinations. And it's not even known. Like I said, the whole thing that being an introvert is considered almost like a disease. Like I said, well, she's introverted, but she'll get over it. You know, poor dear. And in most fiction, that's what they do. Yeah. And as if, you know, being introverted, it was a character defect, you know?
Yeah. I've never quite understood that. Like, everybody can't be loud. You know, like everybody can't have the exact same.
You've never been in my family, right? So everybody can't be loud. All be loud.
Okay, sometimes everybody can be loud.
But yeah, I bet
even all those sensei people have different characteristics too, yeah. Though, right?
Yeah. It's just like, you know, Evo and I were joking. He was saying a Cuban family, and I was saying African American family. And someone said, yeah, and a Jewish family. We all come together. It's like a bar. We all meet up at the same bar. No one for blocks will be able to hear anything for a week. Yeah. So it's truly, yeah. Yeah. It is what it is. It's that whatever is the majority is the standard by which everyone else is judged.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. And so in the US, being an extrovert is the definition of healthy.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in like you said, in Eastern Europe, right, being an extrovert is the person who's trying to get attention. Yeah, you know, if they had more confidence, they wouldn't have to compensate like that.
Yeah.
Right? And then you go to Asia, many Asian countries, traditional countries, the only ones who talk a lot are the women, because that's considered womanly, because to be quiet is considered the strength.
Mm-hmm.
So if you talk too much, you must be a woman. Think about that.
Yeah.
Everything gets projected onto, it's like whatever is the cleave of projection, that's where mm-hmm. it goes. Yeah.
It is really interesting, especially the talking too much and be a woman and thinking about like the studies, you know, like in business settings where men think women talk more than they do. And then when they yeah. actually go in and have someone record, like women talk half to a third as much as the men in meetings. Yeah. But men, if you ask the men after the meeting, they will say the women talked more.
That's right. Because we're not supposed to talk at all. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it's real telling. It's an interesting yeah. cultural phenomenon.
But oh. same thing they found in classrooms where the teachers thought that the girls asked more questions and raised their hand more. But when they actually recorded it, it was like, no, actually, they didn't raise their hands mm-hmm. and they didn't ask questions nor answer the questions to the problems, from, you know, put forward by the teacher. Mm-hmm. And when everyone raised hands, the teachers would decide that the girls had already spoken enough. And so they would discount calling on them when in fact the girls had not been called on.
Yeah. That's perception and reality.
Yeah.
Are interesting. I mean, both in psychology and in writing. Like I think those two things are really interesting. And one of the things you brought up in the book that like I thought about because of the age of my son and partly just thinking about the thing is the parental adult child stack and like when people actually start to kind of test as their right type, you know, around the time they're 28 and around their Saturn return. And I was just thinking about like one of the things you pulled together so beautifully in the book that I had just had not thought about was this actual understanding of psychology and mysticism, and that these things don't have to be mutually exclusive. Right. Like I do think even as people who practice witchcraft and are in pagan space, we still kind of like science is still kind of, it's there and we believe in it, but it isn't always impacting directly on our practice. And I think what particularly that moment in the book, I was just like, oh yeah, these things, I mean, part of what myth with the big M, like you talked about, does is explain things for us. And that's also science's job is to explain things for us. So it was an interesting moment. And I was like, oh, that does show that connection.
Well, yeah. I mean, the thing is we usually think of the soul as being the space for where religion say comes in, or at least spirituality, but mm-hmm. we name it an entire science, psychology, as if the study of the soul is somehow separate from the soul as described in most, you know, traditions, religious mm-hmm. traditions or spiritual traditions. And my thing is that no, modern psychologists are inheritors of the work of the priests and priestesses, shaman, witch doctors, mm-hmm. Gri-Gri women and witches from all over the world. And the idea that they work so hard to put themselves above, that they're scientific, that we use, look, we even have scientific terms. it's very childlike. Look, I have a certificate, says I am a doctor. you know, and I go, yeah, but you're talking about things that are in the spiritual realm. And so now even more, you know, psychologists and social workers and counselors and therapists and analysts are reaching into the spiritual realm to get mm-hmm. practices and understandings and pulling it into the psychological realm by, and refusing at times, some of them, you know, acknowledge the legacy, but so many of them don't acknowledge the legacy of where these things came from. Mm-hmm. And that they, you know, it's not a problem with them using it, but the problem is them not acknowledging that they are part of the same vein of work.
Right.
And we've had collections of pagan counselors, psychologists, therapists, and analysts get together online. There used to be a Yahoo group, and now it's a different kind of group. Mm-hmm. And I was told that I was always invited because I tended to know more about Jungian psychology and its connections to the ancient wisdoms than anybody else. And I said, hey, yes, and I'm the mystic. Mm-hmm. I am firmly on the mystic side. Right. And so what does that tell you? Right? What does that tell you? That this separation is a desperate effort on the part of psychology as an industry to be accepted as a science. Mm-hmm. But the whole point of it is, this is something I'm working on in my body wisdom, is that magic is both a science and the art. And we are doing magic every single day, but we're calling it by different names. And as a result, people don't realize that magic is an integral part of our lives. Mm-hmm. Just the fact now that you and I are talking over interfaces made with rare crystals, you know, with electricity, excuse me, fire flowing through them in the form of light mm-hmm. and heat, and moving from thing to thing and interconnecting with another realm called the cloud. And from that cloud, we're able to communicate, show pictures, share information, send documents back and forth. And we just walk around like it's just normal as the sun coming up. Mm-hmm. What did we say about sufficiently advanced technology?
Yes. That's Arthur C. Clarke, right?
I mean, yeah.
Advanced, yeah. It's funny, my husband and I were talking yesterday. We're in Silicon Valley, so he works in the tech industry. And I was joking about him going to the office with his tech witches. And
yeah, we're magicians.
It was a joke, but you're right. It's kind of real.
It's real. We're magicians. And the fact that they can't call us magicians, right? I've been trying to get a tech mage path at one of the conferences I do, because that's what we are, magicians. Mm-hmm. And that's what the psychologists, counselors, and analysts are, right? They're priests and priestesses of a long-held craft. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they can't own it, just like the tech mages can't own it, mm-hmm. says how far we've gone from being acknowledged that these are art and science together, is what they separated to basically cripple the quote powerless people into not being able to affect the world.
Yeah,
well, that separation.
I feel like there's a little bit of that leaking in. Like, I think, you know, occasionally, you know, I've just encountered like medical professionals or somebody who also looks at, you know, how's your head, you know, they're willing to reintegrate psychology and medicine, which I don't know why we've separated either. And, and then also like, and, you know, have you tried meditation? Have you, you know, I think there's like some of that happening. Like there's a little seed growing of it.
Yeah, but those are the things where they're borrowing from spiritual traditions, but they won't acknowledge the validity of what it comes from. Like
practice, but not the practice. Yeah.
Right. I had a book I was reading because I was going to do some work with some people. And in it, it says, yes, and we're borrowing this from Buddhism because we don't, you know, because we don't want to have to deal with all that Buddhist crap. And I was literally going, what? Oh my God. And we're worried about people burning sage? Look at this.
Like there's other appropriation going on.
Yeah, there's a whole investment going on already.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And so that's a part of that. And it's good. But there also needs to be, it's just like, you know, we need to recognize the African-American contribution to rock and roll, right? Or we have to recognize the role of women in developing what is now called medicine. Mm-hmm. You know, we weren't just the ones who got medicated. We were the ones who were doing it, you know, before the AMA pushed out midwives and unlicensed them in many areas. Mm-hmm. So the thing is, we have to remember the history. Why is it that these are the only people who are, quote, can work in that area? It's because they basically burned, killed, you know, basically humiliated all the other people who had the gifts. So, you know, so they're the only ones that we can go to. Yeah. Thank goodness some of them have the wherewithal to reach back and pull on those practices. Mm-hmm. But we need to heal these rifts. And to me, it's always important to acknowledge and recognize and be grateful for the ancient sources of our craft. Mm-hmm. That's, that is so important.
That is like the perfect statement. And I think a good place for me to ask, you've already mentioned one upcoming project, but like, do you want to talk a little bit more about that? Or do you want to let people know where they can connect with you? And then we'll do our last game of chance question.
Okay. I'm really looking forward to that. Vitae Wisdom is about healing the streams. It's about healing the streams at all levels. So when I call the three streams, the body, the mind, and the soul. But the soul I'm talking about is the group soul for humanity, that we don't have connections to it. That's why we seem to be wandering around doing things that are just so contraindicated life, you know? We're, you know, chopping down the trees that provide oxygen. We're using up the water in places to create commerce in water, not water for drinking out of faucets. You know, we're doing all these things and we're pretending like the repercussions don't exist. Although now no one is stepping up and saying there's no such thing as climate change. They're too busy running around like their heads are cut off. But it's like, without that connection between our bodies and mind, that our bodies and mind and our connection to our group soul, obviously through our own soul, we need to bring them back into alignment. Right now, we are prisoners of our minds. We are prisoners of our minds. We create culture and systems that are anti-body, that don't support life. And the only way we can justify that is if we think that our minds can exist without our bodies. And I'm always saying that the film The Matrix was an excellent, it set up a great symbolic representation of what exactly has been happening to humanity since the dawn of the industrial age. And that is the dehumanization of people into like robots, mm-hmm. into bots, interchangeable bots. And it shows up in lots of different ways. But the main reason that I bring it up now is, if you realize that's the problem, then there's only one solution, and that's for the bots to rebel and leave. Mm-hmm. And right now we're dealing with the Great Resignation, which is exactly that.
Yeah.
People are saying, I'm a human being and you got to treat me as a human being, mm-hmm. or I'm leaving. Yeah. And that is the greatest thing. The Great Resignation is the greatest thing. And it may allow us to move to the next stage of our development as a species. So we can grow the hell up and act, you know, appropriately in our with our fellow beings on the planet. But that's what the book I'm working on is about, is examining the ways in which our inability to connect directly with our bodies is interfering with our ability to have a positive impact on the world.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to reading that too, as I have already ordered your Descent book.
Cool. And then you said,
where to connect with you, where can folks connect with you?
I was going to say my website, but my last discovery while I was working on a huge project that my website is kind of like messed up. So they can connect with me on Facebook for now. Mm-hmm. I hardly ever go on it, but Angela goes on it. She will bring things to my attention. God is bless her.
Great. Okay. Yeah, and I'll make sure there's a link to Facebook stuff in the show notes. Yeah, for everybody.
Yeah, someone there is Katrina Messenger, the author. I also have a personal page, but you know, if you want to connect with me as a teacher and a writer, then go through the author page, and then and then sometimes I'll pop up on either my school, so it'll be Reflectionist Mystery School is on there, Connect DC is on there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I saw there's like a dark moon or new moon meditation with Connections DC.
We do meditation.
I watched a couple of those.
We went online with our ritual because we do all the solar rituals. And right before I had, Angela and I had talked about doing a full moon meditation in person. So we were doing in-person full moon meditations, and then COVID hit. And it was like, oh my God, what do we do, like everybody else? And so we moved everything online. So we did the rituals online where everybody was online so that mm-hmm. they were doing it over Zoom. And mm-hmm. And so Angela said, I'll just do the full moon meditations there. And then I was joking. I said, well, you know, I could go on and do my rant. And so we agreed that dark moon would be the best time for that. So.
No, I enjoyed those a lot. Okay. So I'm going to roll and die. And
yes,
this is the part where, although I have said initially with the podcast that, you know, this is an opportunity to talk about things we're not supposed to talk about, but really the whole podcast works that way.
Yes.
But this is a more specific pointed question. So if I roll, depending on what number I roll, we'll talk about death, sex, religion, politics, or money. And if I roll a six, you get to pick your topic of choice. And you got a six, so you get to pick.
I there were no interference from. What were the choices?
Death, sex, religion, politics, or money.
Let's talk about money.
Okay, this is one of my favorite questions for writers. Is there something as a writer that you are absolutely not willing to do for free, or is there something as a writer you would never do for money?
As a writer, I once I publish a book, I'm not giving it away for free. That it represents an exchange that needs to happen to make it possible for me to write. It's very seldom anybody's going to get rich off of this. You know, the folks who do are very, it's more going on. But I feel like it's a fair exchange. And part of that is my old Marxist background. It's like, I've done the work. I feel that I've priced it reasonably. I am not doing that for free. Mm-hmm. And I'm also not going to present the material in there without some type of compensation. A lot of people have asked me over the years to do things, where they couldn't pay me. And I would ask, well, can I sell my books? Because that can help make up for that, mm-hmm. right? But if I can't sell my books and they're not going to pay me, they're not even going to pay my transportation, it's like, you know what? That's not fair. That's not fair. People who have means, they can do that, and it makes it difficult for those of us without means, and that we're supposed to live up to that standard of, give away your time, your talent, your energy when you're basically struggling. And to me, that's a form of privilege that mm-hmm. we need to stop raising up. And we need to pay writers for their work and pay for the work they've put in to create their body of work. Mm-hmm. And that means paying them when they come to talk about it. And I think that's really important. Yeah. Now,
can we shout that louder for the people in the back?
yes. And then the other part was,
what would you not do even if they offered to pay you?
Oh, Well, I'll tell you a story. And this is something Angela could have told you, is that I've always have stories. That's also how I teach.
Hey, so that makes you a great podcast guest.
Oh, good. I did a newscast thing about that woman in Delaware who said she was a witch who was running for Congress, who said she had been a witch. And that she, and come to find out, no, she wasn't a witch. She had been to something she thought was witchy, and she joked about sitting on the altar of something. And I was like, no, you didn't. No. So anyway, so they were, because she was running for office, and there was something about her being Republican or whatever, that they were looking, you know, here in DC, they often come to the pagan community looking for someone to speak on behalf. And what everybody does is they all send them to me.
Unofficial witch spokesperson of DC.
Yeah. And so one of the things was I went on the news and explained, and they walked around in my temple, and they, you know, around, they found a broom on my porch, and they were like really excited and made a joke about it not being like in Hogwarts, you know, in Harry Potter. And so there was a couple of things. And so it went on the national news, and it got syndicated all, you know, and lots of people saw it. And I got all these things from people. I think it was on, back then it was on Facebook. It was either Facebook or LiveJournal. I think it was Facebook, who were saying, thank you, Katrina, because they always get the crazy ones to do a thing about witches. And so they were really happy with me. Well, I didn't know how far this stuff went out, but apparently there's this restaurant. Well, I don't know if she's still around. It's here in DC. That's pretty famous, called Cafe Nora. And she has Cafe Nora, and she had another restaurant. And she's a local, you know, bigwig. And she saw the report and decided, she's a witch that people know about. They've seen it. I'm having a dinner party. So I got contacted by her to come do read tarot at her party.
For free.
No, I assume.
Oh, she offered to pay you.
Right. And I, or they were going to, each person would pay me. So there was money, but, and I was like, you know what? I'm not entertainment. I'm entertaining. I am not entertainment.
Yeah. That sounds like that would have just been deeply unpleasant.
Yeah. Now, I've read tarot for my block parties where I sit out in front of my house with a, you know, little card table, mm-hmm. and read for everybody, you know. But mostly it's kids and cops. Cops always want to know something for free. Anyway.
Interesting.
But yeah, I turned down the owner and founder of Cafe Nora.
I think it should be a claim to fame. Reading.
Yeah.
You should add that. You should add that to your bio on the website. Okay. Oh, I love that story. Thank you so much. And thank you for being on the show. I'm so glad that Angela, who we've mentioned her several times, she's your assistant, like your personal assistant.
Angela is one of the fabulous local priestesses. She is.
Oh, okay. Okay.
She was Angela Raincatcher. She was formerly the celebrant of Becoming, which was a pagan church here in DC. And she's now a member of my tradition. And she is powerful priestess. She's the convener of Connect DC now.
Oh, excellent.
And she was the founder of DC Pagan Pride. So yeah.
Oh, awesome. Okay. Well, she reached out on your behalf and then we connected. So I'm just grateful that all of these lovely connections have happened through the podcast and I got to meet you and have you on the show. So thank you.
Thank you. I really enjoyed myself. And as you can tell, I spend a lot of time enjoying myself in conversation.
Well, I'm happy to have contributed to that and be part of it. So thank you.
All righty. Thank you, darling.
Witchlit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Kaifel Agostini, who also designed our logo. Our music is Voices, composed for us by Alexander Shanekar. You can support our work, get early access to episodes, ask your own death, sex, religion, politics, money questions, and get some free stuff by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/witchlitpod. Transcripts and all our previous episodes are available at witchlitpod.com, and you can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at @witchlitpod. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and consider giving us a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. It helps other witches find the show. Thanks for listening and for reading Witchy.